In the book of Daniel in the 8th chapter, and I want to read a little bit and then talk a little bit and hopefully have some discussion that will be helpful both to you and to me as we pursue on hopefully tonight into the 9th chapter. In our study last week, we got into the 8th chapter quite a distance, and I want to pick up the reading beginning at verse 15, and I want to discuss the verses beginning at verse 21 through the end of the chapter. But to pick up the reading at verse 15, the writer says, "And it came to pass, when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision, that I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was affrighted, and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, Understand, O son of man, for the vision belongeth to the time of the end. Now as he was speaking with me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright, and he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the latter time of the indignation, for it belongeth to the appointed time of the end. The ram which thou sawest, that had the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough he-goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king." Now, just to catch up a little bit, identifying the king of Greece and then down to the first king, who would that be? We talked about that. Randy?
Alexander.
It says at verse 22, "And as for that which was broken, in the place whereof four stood up, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not with his power." Now, four kingdoms would come from this one. What's he talking about? Randy?
He's talking about the four generals that took over when Alexander died.
All right, we talked about that in our last study. It says in verse 23, now here's where I want you to think with me and to help me in my understanding. "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a fierce king, or a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences, shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and do his pleasure. And he shall destroy the mighty ones and the holy people. And through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. And he shall magnify himself in his heart, and in their security shall he destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which hath been told, is true. But shut thou up the vision, for it belongeth unto many days to come. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Then I rose up and did the king's business, and I wondered at the vision, but none understood it." Now in these verses, this fierce king, or king of fierce countenance, we've talked about the atrocities that King Antiochus committed against the people of God, against the city of Jerusalem. And we've discussed in our discussion last Wednesday evening whether or not this king was pointed at Rome, or whether or not this king was the one Antiochus. And either direction you go on that, certainly there's application of the things that are discussed in these verses, but I'm persuaded, at least at this point in my study, that he's talking about Antiochus, who has descended from these kings, from Alexander's kingdom. Now, my reason for that is that in verse 24, it talks about not by his own power, and his power shall be mighty. Antiochus' power was indeed mighty, as we've seen and noted the atrocities committed against the people of God. However, it says he shall not by his own power. The theme of this book is what? We've identified it a number of times. What's the theme of the book? God rules in the kingdoms of men. God rules in the kingdoms of men. When any man is brought to a position of power, God did that. And whether it be Antiochus or some other king, God did that, brought this man to a place of power. It says in verse 24, "And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper, and do his pleasure, and he shall destroy the mighty ones and the holy people." Again identified, whatever this king would do, it would affect the people of God. Now we've studied how the Antiochus committed, as we've said, atrocities against the sanctuary. And as you'll back up in the reading of the text in verse 13, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said unto that certain one who spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the continual burnt offering and the transgressions that make desolate, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot?" Now what was it that we know that Antiochus did to the city of Jerusalem? What were some of the kind of things that he did to the people of God when he came through the city? Yes. All right. All right. Now, we read that, did we not, from the book of 1 Maccabees to get the history of that. And again, I don't have to reiterate what I think about 1 and 2 Maccabees or any of those other additional books, do I? But we see them as books of history that can be informative to us to learn what happened during the time between the two Testaments, the Old and the New Testament. And by the way, just for review, how long was that period of time? About 400 years, that's right, of God's silence. But we can see in history some of the things that occurred during that period of silence. Yes, David? All right. We're going to talk about those blessings and curses, and in particular, as we get into the next chapter, as we read about the prayer of Daniel on behalf of the people and the sins that he acknowledges that the people committed. Yes. Well, I answered it that way, David, for this reason. These kings were so inclined to do what they pleased, but God could utilize and use them to accomplish His purposes. Point being, even as we look at Satan himself, it was Satan's desire to conquer and to crucify the Christ. But through the implementations of certain men, he was able to accomplish that. But God was able to use those men to accomplish the very purpose for which he sent his Son into the world. Again, point being, here were some who accomplished the will of God, though that was not their intent to do that. But God utilized them to accomplish those things. Now, looking back at our text just a little bit, this one who took pleasure in doing the things that he did, destroyed the mighty ones and the holy people. These were those who, I'm persuaded, inhabited the city of Jerusalem and were treated, Randy, in the way that you identified just a moment ago. It says, "And through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and in their security shall he destroy many." Let's pause there once again. In our study of the things that Antiochus did, and again, whether this be Antiochus or some other king, what was the means of destroying people? What did he do to conquer people? Did he arise or raise a trust in himself and then betray them? Well, that's what the text tells us that he did. He deceived the people. And we do know that certain kings used that method of conquering people. They would create alliances with people and then betray them. Antiochus did those kind of things, and I think that we could illustrate that. But he destroyed many because they were secure or in their security. It says, "He shall stand up against the prince of princes." Who's that? Back over in the 11th verse, it says, "Yea, it magnified itself, even to the prince of hosts, and took away from him the continual burnt offerings, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. Who is the prince of princes? Well, perhaps Christ, or perhaps even as we think about God and the sanctuary where he was worshipped in the city of Jerusalem. And who was it that magnified himself? The one who desecrated the temple and exalted himself to that particular role. Now, the thing I want to notice in particular in verse 25, it says, "But he shall be broken without hand." Someone elaborate on that. What's going to happen to this one who has so magnified himself? I'm sorry, verse 25, the last expression of verse 25. He shall be broken without hand. Without hand. He shall be broken without hand. That works. All right.
And I think that goes well here. I mean, he's stood up against God, and God's going to strike him down, as it were.
All right. Yes.
With hand would be if he were taken out and stoned or beaten or something like that.
Or defeated in a battle?
Yeah, or in a battle.
Uh-huh. All right. All right. Yes, Judy?
My Bible says without human agency.
All right. That's what I think, Randy. Is that what yours said, the New American Standard? And so that's correct. He would die without human agency. Anybody know about the history of Antiochus, how he died? Did he die in battle? Pardon me? He became ill and died. That's right. So he died without hands. She did good, didn't she? Yeah, he died without hands. Tommy?
It's hard to avoid the comparison with Herod, who he didn't puff himself up as God, but when people said, "Hark the voice of a God," he didn't rebuke them. And of course, God struck him down, he died as well.
That's right. So there could be an application in either way. Or either application of this. I think that's true. But whoever it was, we see that God was in control. And God was the one who took care of whoever it was that had exalted himself to this elevation. Any questions or comments just here? Terry, go ahead.
No, I don't know. I might be in the minority viewpoint.
That's okay. So he came near where I stood, and when he came up, I was affrighted and fell upon my face. But he said unto me, "Understand, O son of man, for the vision belongeth to the time of the end."
I'm thinking about a timeline here. He seems to be setting the context of the vision here. Vision refers to time of the end. So that kind of begs the question, what is the time of the end?
Right, right.
And then, in verse 24, the statement is, "He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people." So, the question would Antiochus destroy all the people.
Well, an alternate reading from the American Standard is to corrupt the holy people.
Do you have the original word there?
No, I don't. You have that on your computer there, Richard.
We're in,
Verse 24. He shall destroy the mighty ones and the holy people.
Destroy. Shakak, a print of root to decay, i.e. positively to ruin, literally or figuratively. In the King James Version, it's translated batter, cast off, corrupt, or corrupter, corrupting thing, destroy, destroyer, lose, mar, perish, spill, spoil, utterly waste.
That's a nice specific definition. Yeah, that don't help us, Terry.
It's used 147 times in the old testament.
Yeah, that don't help us either. Okay. Well, I'm interested in your comments on verses 26 in particular, as it speaks of the vision of the evenings and mornings, which hath been told is true, the evenings and the mornings being discussed in verse 14. If we're identifying this with Roman entities, then I don't know, maybe it's just me, I'm having a little trouble reconciling numbers.
Yeah, you're having just the opposite problem I'm having with, really with verse 17.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Either way we go on this.
Either way. Yeah.
Either way we go on this. I think that's right. In verse 26, in the latter part of the verse in particular, Daniel is told to shut up the vision, for it belongeth to many days to come. He's forecasting something that is way out there that's giving Daniel a great deal of trouble. Yes, Tommy, I'm sorry. That may be helpful. Yeah. Yes, Randy?
I was kind of thinking the same thing, but verse 20, when Gabriel is explaining this, he says the ram with the two horns represents why don't we just automatically accept it? When it talks about the time of the end, it's talking about the time of the end of the Medo-Persian Empire.
Well, I don't think that that's the application that is consistent with the rest of the book.
That's what I don't understand. Because we were talking about it in chapter 7, it was talking about the fourth kingdom, talking about Rome. And then chapter 8 focuses in on the Medo-Persian Empire and how the Greek Empire took it.
Yeah. I may begin with an opinionated book slant already on the book before I start studying it. Tommy? Well, to answer, that's right. Well, to answer Randy's question, the book of Daniel, I think, is laid in overlays, as we've talked about before. And some emphasize one kingdom more than the other, but there's a direction to which the book is pointed. And I think the book is pointed to the coming of the Messiah, as you pointed out, and then to the end of the Jewish entity with the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. I think that's where the book is pointed. We'll get there, I think, in time. But to see the overlays of that, I think it has to be consistent with the overall view of the book, and it's one over another.
I guess what I'm thinking is, what he talked about is the time of the end in verse 17, and then in verse 19, he says, "Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end."
Yeah. Go ahead.
The thinking has to be done on that word there in verse 19, indignation.
Yeah, go ahead.
The indignation is tied in with the appointed time the end shall be.
That takes us back to Luke, doesn't it?
He's going to tell
us. Well, Terry and I have talked about this at some length. And from Luke chapter 21, beginning at verse 20, and in particular verse 22, says, "But when you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that her desolation is at hand. Then let them that are in Jerusalem flee into the mountains, and let them that are in the midst of her depart out. And let not them that are in the country enter therein, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written must or may be fulfilled." Now when you parallel these accounts, and notice that Luke talks about the days of vengeance, Matthew refers that to the abomination of desolation. And he's taking that back to the book of Daniel, which we'll study some more, I guess, when we get to that. Hold that thought. John's had his hand up for quite a while.
In 17, if you're looking for what the time of the end is, it says the vision pertains to the time of the end. So the vision deals with the time of the end. If you look at the vision, it starts in the point of view, it goes from Medes and Persia down to Greece and Rome. So that's the time of the end. Medes and Persia, Greece, Rome. It's not a day, it's a period.
Okay, I could buy into some of that. Terry?
Yeah, I think what John is saying is that if you look at, as an example, let's look at the period of, shall we say, Jewish history from the time that Moses receives the law on Mount Sinai to the destruction of Jerusalem. How much history do we have there? Some 1,200 years plus.
Mm-hmm.
If we go from the time before Greek kingdoms and Antiochus Epiphanes through the destruction of Jerusalem, you have there probably 400 years remaining out of a total of 1,200 years. So that could be looked at as a period of time. But in any instance, whether one takes the view that this is done by Antiochus or because of certain phrases and certain verses that this is talking more about Rome than it is Antiochus. It's in either case, it still doesn't get you beyond, as you were mentioning.
Right. That's the key.
So it doesn't get you beyond or project beyond 70 AD.
I think that's key.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to note in here, even though chapter 8 focuses on the Medo-Persian and the Grecian empires to the greatest extent and to the most clear extent, we do see that it starts off with Belshazzar, who is he not the last king of the Babylonian Empire?
Right.
So it starts off with the Babylonian Empire. It talks about the Medo-Persian Empire. It talks about that empire being destroyed by Greece. And then right down at the end, it says that whomever we're speaking of here, that's a Grecian king, that he'll be destroyed without hand. In other words, the implication there is that the next kingdom then is thereon.
Yeah.
And so we
that's
actually
true.
Have all four of the kingdoms mentioned in 2 and 7 right here in 8 also.
Okay.
And,
that's right.
I would propose that actually that this history doesn't go past Acts, the second chapter. But that's where the last kingdom, as it were, was destroyed. And that's when God's kingdom that shall be eternal was established.
Well, we'll talk some about that. That may be right. Randy?
The four generals that took over after Alexander, one of them was not Antiochus, right?
Seleucid.
The Antiochus who came in...
came from the Seleucid kings.
And persecuted them. He was like a grandson or something, right?
Right.
So that's why he would fit this picture as a king, not one of those four.
Correct.
But during the latter period of their rule, a king will arise, insolent and skilled.
Yeah. That's what I was saying as a possibility. We talked about that some last week.
If this does talk about him, then it wouldn't be, then Rome is not seen here at all.
True. But what we're saying is there are two possible courses that our study could go. We could look at it over here as finding some fulfillment in Antiochus, or we could go in another direction over here and find some fulfillment in Rome.
But not both.
But not both.
Okay,
no.
Because what I was looking at, be broken without human agency, who's the first Caesar? Julius?
Well, not Julius. There was one before him. Help me out, Terry. Octavius? Yes, before he met with...
Before he was entangled in political affairs and defeated by Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
Was he murdered?
I think he was. And he might have been murdered in Egypt.
That was my thinking,
well,
but I'm not certain by any means.
But Julius Caesar was murdered too.
Yes, by...
So both of them came to an end with the human
being. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he pointed out, Tommy pointed out that Herod, along in the string of this, died of disease.
I got a question maybe you could help me on.
Probably not.
In the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, right, we're not talking about that at all here, right?
Not particularly here, no. We're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem at the hand of Antiochus as a possibility here.
Because I hear when Rome comes in,
yeah,
that's the AD 70 thing.
Right.
That's where I'm getting confused.
Yeah.
I hear Rome, because
yeah,
I know in AD 70, according to history, not a single saint lost their life.
Right, among the saints, that's true.
Among the saints, so
here we're looking perhaps, though, at the term, and I think this has been discussed in times past, the term saints as it applies simply to the redeemed or to God's people in a more general way. And the holy ones here, I have a footnote at the side that says saints in our chapter 8. So the application would be to those who were among the people of God. So whoever we're talking about, whether it be Roman kings that inflicted persecution upon the people of God, or whether we're talking about Antiochus who did that, as we've studied last week, the application can go in either direction and still, I think, have considerable merit to it.
About what years did Antiochus
rule? He died in 164.
B.C.
Yeah. All right. I want to get to the next chapter is what I want to do. We notice in verse 26 it says, "But shut thou up the vision, for it belongeth to many days to come. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Then I rose up and did the king's business, and I wondered at the vision, but none understood it." Now sometimes I know some of you and I have studied from the book of Daniel and come to the conclusion that, well, Daniel is sick because he didn't understand some of these things and they're difficult to understand, and so we get sick when we try to study them. That's really just a funny ha-ha. That's not the case here. The case here was Daniel is reflecting upon what is to be in the history of his people, what this vision means to him, and it made him sick to his stomach to think about what was going to happen to the people of God. Any comment or question on that? Okay.
In that context, that, you know, Daniel is very worried and is trying to understand how this vision and plan that he sees, what's going to happen to the Jewish people, how that's all part of the plan of God.
John?
Sorry, I have a question. I don't know that it can be answered. But
probably not. Well, no, I don't think there's really a conflict there. When he's told to keep it secret, the idea there is it's not time yet for these things to be made known. The idea that none understood it does not necessarily mean that Daniel told it. I lost my train of thought. It'll come to me. I had something to say about that. Randy and then Chris. I'll try to think of what I was going to say.
I just got from that Gabriel's gone now. You know, Gabriel was the one who was explaining it.
Oh, that was my train of thought. If it's not understandable in the sense that no man could possibly understand it, even if Daniel made it known, then it would seem ironic that the angel Gabriel was there to explain it to Daniel with the instruction, make this man understand. Certainly we can't come to the conclusion that Gabriel was incapable of doing what he was commanded. Daniel understood it, but the complexity of it was such that to reveal history to other people and cause them to understand it before it occurred, no man understood it. Okay? Does that help a little bit? Chris, and then Tommy. Okay, Chris. Fainted?
Is that not?
I think there's similarities between the two, yes. But to suggest that the word faint in verse 27 means that he was asleep or deep sleep in an unconscious state, I don't think that's it. He just drew back when he considered the magnitude of what's been made known to him. For example, we might say that when somebody receives some really, really bad news, that they faint. Well, we're not necessarily talking about somebody passing out, although that's a possibility, but I don't think that's the case here. He just drew back upon the magnitude of the things that have been made known to him. Katie?
The American standard is exhaustion.
Okay. Yeah. No, that he just fell asleep. Yeah, I think there's a difference in falling asleep and passing out. Although I've heard one referred to by the other. Does that help a little bit?
No.
Not really? Carolyn? In a trance,
or kind of an altered state, you know, where, because he talks in that previous place where, you know, I really was here, but in my vision I was over here. God has put it in some sort of a different state where he's, you know, today we might call it a trance, but that's certain, you know, overtones or whatever, but where he's having this vision, and it could be if somebody tried to come and rouse him, he might seem like he was asleep, but he's really not sleeping like normal.
Yes.
Maybe the last chapter of Daniel 12, verse 9, might also be maybe part of the remote context of the 27th verse.
Well, it would have to be part of the remote context, I think.
Yeah.
Go there.
Closed up and sealed.
Yeah. It's not time to make these things known.
There were the secret things of God not to be made known at this particular time.
Right. I think that's accurate. Any other questions on the 8th chapter? All right, Jenny and Chris. I guess that's possible. I hadn't really thought of it in that light, however. I suppose that's possible. Chris?
So he's not supposed to tell anybody yet. So when was this written down?
Daniel is writing just after the captivity began. And that would be about 606 is when the captivity began. So I would assume that he's writing a year or two after the captivity began, because he's taken captive as a youth.
Okay, so it wasn't recorded right after the vision? No.
Donna?
18
and 27, two different instances. 18 and 27? Yes. No. No, they're two separate instances. Okay.
It's interesting to note that in the book of Daniel, this word for fainted is used numerous times, but this is the only place where it's translated fainted.
That is interesting.
So the word here is just a very generic word. It's used over 3,500 times in the Testament. So it's not very definitive.
Yeah. So you can't just get a good dictionary definition and say that's it.
I don't think so.
Randy?
The New American Standard has a marginal reference that says, or done in.
Okay.
I was done in.
Exhausted.
He was wore out.
Withdrawn. I got the picture. Okay. Well, let's move on, if we can, then, to the 9th chapter, because it introduces some thoughts to us, I think, that are going to be further helpful, especially as we get over into the 24th verse. Now, it's unlikely we're going to get there tonight, I just wanted to kind of give a brief overview now of what we have in the previous verses of the ninth chapter. Obviously, you've read this up and, well, probably through the end of the book, but you've read this up through, I'm sure, about verse 19 in particular, to notice the prayer that Daniel is expressing unto God. The date of the prayer is identified in the text in verse 1. It's in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. Now, in our study so far, we've discussed the relationship between Cyrus and Darius. And what was that relationship? We've discussed them relative to the big horn, the little horn, one longer than the other, and so forth. What was the significance of Darius and Cyrus in their relationship to each other? Cyrus was king of what? King of Persia. Darius was king of what? The Medes. Which one was the predominant power? The Persian power. So what we want to see here is that in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. The realm of the Chaldeans was what? All right, a particular part of Babylon. And this is the portion that Darius has the opportunity to rule over. He's not ruling over the whole empire. So we need to keep that clear when we're identifying these kings and the descent of these kings. In verse 2, it tells us that he was made, or I'm sorry, I wanted to get this point in before I forget it. The time of this particular first year of Darius is about 538 B.C. Now, Chris, that'll help you to put some of these events on the timeline, as you'll notice that the things that Daniel saw throughout this book, he didn't see them all at one time. I think maybe we may have left a wrong impression there. These are visions that occurred with Daniel over a period of almost 70 years of the captivity of the Babylonians. Things that he's seeing that are in a prophetic nature of what's to happen to the people of God. And the time frame now of this particular vision is in the first year of Darius, which would date it about 538 B.C. Now, why does Daniel pray? Why does he pray? The text tells us at verse 2, it says, "In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years whereof the word of Jehovah came to Jeremiah the prophet, for the accomplishing of the desolations of Jerusalem, even 70 years." Now, Daniel is telling us a good bit of information in those expressions. Daniel knew of the prophecy that came from the books. Now, I think that's interesting in relation to what he says here about the prophecy of Jeremiah. Jeremiah had prophesied, and let's turn to it and read it, in Jeremiah chapter 25, beginning at verse 9. Jeremiah 25, beginning at verse 9. Well, let's begin at verse 8. It says, "Therefore thus saith Jehovah of hosts, because ye have not heard my words, behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send them unto Nebuchadnezzar the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and I will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and a hissing, and perpetual desolations. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of myrrh, and the voice of gladness, and the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones, and the light of the lamp. And this whole land shall be a desolation, and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years." And Jeremiah was very specific in what he had to say regarding the time of the captivity. Now, Daniel's captivity in Babylon spanned nearly this whole time of 70 years. We know that he served under Cyrus for a particular period of time in the Medo-Persian Empire, which tells us the span of his period of captivity. Also, I think that as we look at the 29th chapter of Jeremiah, And notice in verse 10, again, he became very specific. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 10. It says, "For thus saith Jehovah, after 70 years are accomplished for Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place." Now, you'll notice in Jeremiah 29, there's a prophecy not only of the period of captivity, but a period of time when they would be released from captivity. Now, who brought that about?
Cyrus
did. That's good. Cyrus brought that about, allowed them to return to their homeland. And, of course, you can read that in the beginning of the words of Ezra, chapter 1, beginning at verse 1. But as we look at Daniel chapter 9, and notice in particular verse 2, when it says that Daniel understood by the books the number of years. Books. That indicates some things that are just what Jeremiah has to say. Turn with me, if you will, to Isaiah in chapter 44 and 45. We notice the one who is the people of God to return to their homeland. Isaiah chapter 44 and 45. In Isaiah 44, noting at the verse 28, it says, "That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open the doors before him. The gates shall not be closed." Now, as you'll notice in the beginning of the ninth chapter, who is ruling? Darius is. What does that suggest about Cyrus? He's ruling too. Thank you. I thought nobody was going to see that.
He's not ruling.
Well, he's... Darius is a subsidiary of Cyrus. So Cyrus is the top dog, so to speak.
Darius is king junior.
Yeah. He's king only over a portion of the empire. Now, these books that Daniel is evidently familiar with would have to do with prophecies regarding the period of captivity. And certainly you can't eliminate what Isaiah has to say about the coming of a new king who's going to let the people go home. That factors into the timeline, doesn't it, Terry? This new king, is that twice? That's going to let these people go home sets some dates on the timeline for us. So we'll pick up with the ninth chapter in our next study. Now don't forget, next week we won't be studying from Daniel. That will be the week of our gospel meeting. So be prepared for our gospel meeting. When we resume our study, I would encourage you to the little time